want to both be polite about the fact and be honest about it. We, the United States of America, through our elected representatives and through civil servants who represent our interests, committed monstrous crimes in 2021, which are against the laws, traditions, and constitution of the United States of America, including aggressively redlining the provision of life-saving medical care in a way which was designed to cause racially discriminatory outcomes with the provision of medical care. The state of California institutionally believed that we can only, expose availability of the vaccine in this location, the central warehouse, where the vaccine is not actually available to any healthcare seeker. And we said, no, the actual place that healthcare is delivered is these 45 locations that your spreadsheet does not know exist, but that we do. We have called them, and here are the subset of that 45 that actually have it available. And I felt a little bit of frustration as a software engineer who has no reason to understand, how the University of California healthcare system at CityX conducts healthcare delivery. Why am I explaining this to public health officials? Why don't they already know this? But we often found ourselves in that sort of situation. There are people who are no longer with us as a result of this. And I feel we owe it to ourselves, we owe it to history, and we, not to put too fine a point on it, owe it to the dead to be honest about what we did and for the purpose of doing this better the next time. If, God willing, we never see a respiratory pandemic again in our lifetimes, but if it happens again, we must do better.
So today I'm speaking once again with Patrick McKenzie. This time I'll be interviewing him rather than the other way around. Patrick's also known as Patio 11 on the internet. Prolific writer about institutions and finance, an angel investor, senior advisor at Stripe, and recently, or several years ago, the CEO of the extraordinary Vaccinate CA effort, which provided information about vaccine availability to millions of Americans, a task which, as we'll discuss, the US government proved itself incapable of. Patrick, lovely to be talking to you again.
Thanks very much, and I'll make the obligatory disclaimer that your audience is probably very familiar with. All of my views are my own and not necessarily the views of other institutions I've been affiliated with, such as Stripe or Call the Shots, which ran the Vaccinate CA initiative. And they might also not be representative of other board members of the organization, employees, funders, and similar, or our government or tech industry partners. That disclaimer out of the way, let's go to the juicy stuff.
Great. So just before we started recording, we were talking about the phenomenon that is LinkedIn and copy and pasting knowledge from primarily Twitter about issues like AI into LinkedIn, these sort of influences that establish credibility amongst an institutional audience that maybe isn't plugged into AI research, and then going on to speak at these institutions, in my experience, with negative consequences. You were just actually speaking at the Bank of England, and I understand as well that your newsletter, Bits About Money, is doing the rounds in the likes of Washington, D.C. Can you tell us about how that's been going?
Yeah, so nobody is more surprised about this than me, although I'm less surprised at it as my career advances. I still have a self-conception as this. I got my start working for the internet, writing bingo card creation software next to a rice paddy in central Japan. And now, descriptively speaking, it seems like the Senate Banking Committee and staff members thereof read Bits About Money very attentively and ask excellent questions based on it, including of other people, that a little worrisomely. Well, for them, not for me. Similarly, I received an email a few weeks ago from the Bank of England, and not that I'm so unaware about how the world operates that I'm surprised that the Bank of England has email accounts, but I was surprised to get that email. And they said, in essence, we became aware of you a few years ago when you were on Tyler Cohen's podcast. You seem to not be an axe murderer. We've followed your stuff since then. And, we're central bankers here. We deal with systemic risks to the financial system. We feel pretty good about some of those systemic risks. We feel less good about having an understanding of the technical realities of software in payment systems and in the financial system generally. And you seem to be credible on that subject. Can you come in and talk to us about it? And so I flew out to London to walked on down to Threadneedle Street and then chatted with them for an hour about three topics. They gave me permission to publish a derivative of that, and so I'll publish it in my own spaces in the next couple of weeks. But we talked about stablecoins, about AI, and whether it represents additional systemic risks to banking. And then I spent a lot of time walking through one particular incident, the CrowdStrike Falcon incident of July 2024, which extremely negatively affected the U.S. banking sector in a way that is less than institutionally legible. I wanted to bring them in. So here's the after-action report that I was able to find by the Fed. And it seems like the Fed is kind of busy right now and has not written that after-action report. But I gave them the gloss of Microsoft's after-action report and CrowdStrike's after-action report and said, I don't want to brag, but I am an American, and I did successfully pre-anticipate many of the things that were in these reports several weeks earlier in my newsletter. So you should probably read that if you don't already. Yeah, interesting time was had by all.
Yeah, and I guess to the Bank of England's credit, they made sure to give you a couple of years before bringing you on as well, rather than searching around for somebody that seemed vaguely credible from social media. Oh, yeah, that you'll do.
Legibility, I don't know how many times I've given a shout-out to Singh Like a State in my various works, and it's quite popular in our community, but it is just downright difficult for institutions to legibly decide who has credibility on various topics. And social media gives them a wider reach than they previously had. They don't just have to like sort by institutional prestige and say, okay, you were previously at Harvard. That sounds good. You have a PhD. That sounds good. All right, we can bring you in to talk about macroeconomics. There's, you know, nobody knows if you're on the internet, and nobody knows if you're getting 1,000 likes per tweet or LinkedIn post, whether those likes are coming from, relatively well-calibrated people evaluating you, or from a botnet that you've hired, or from just folks who are like maybe not should be as weighted in the decision-making process as they are by default if one is just sorting by likes descending.
Sure. So I'm keen to talk about the implications of Vaccinate CA. You and I, when we were in San Francisco together after our interview, we sort of talked at length around some of the implications, as I said, it's a story that I think hasn't received anywhere near the level of scrutiny and attention it deserves. I've recommended to my audience previously and written about it online. Go read Patrick's a breakdown on works in progress. It's long, but absolutely just a microcosm of modern institutional failures. You've also talked about the saga, particularly I'm thinking of the Dorkish Patel's interview, which I think again worth if you're not familiar with the story, go check that out. Before we kind of go take that next step, would you be able to just give us a sort of a 5-minute refresher of how that came about?
Absolutely. So I'd like to ask the audience to cast yourself back to where we were in early 2021. There were widespread media reports in the United States that the vaccine had been substantially delivered in November/December of 2020. The physical artifact was available earlier, but the FDA approval only came down in November. Distribution began in many places in December. And it was originally prioritized based on guidelines which were created by various central government actors in the United States and then promulgated to the several states and local authorities with some amount of variation based on where exactly you were, what exact authority you were listening to, and day by day, week by week, sometimes multiple times a day, changes in policy. We can get into all that. But there were widespread media reports in January of 2021 that said patients and caregivers of patients, most typically their adult children, are calling dozens of medical providers across the state of California to find who physically has the vaccine available for patients that the tiering system says are immediately eligible to receive it. And on reading these media reports, I got frustrated on behalf of my friends and family in the state of California and thought, Clearly, the California tech industry is capable of centralizing this information. Just publish one website somewhere that has the information of who physically has these vaccines in inventory. And then rather than every patient calling every doctor's office and every pharmacy, just look at the website, find the people that will say yes if you call, and then engage them in whatever process is required to get an appointment, whether that's calling or going to their website or going to the county health department or similar. And I tweeted out on, I think, about January 14th, you know, if someone wanted to do an excellent civic technology project, you could create a web page, do the work of calling around to get the information to put on that web page, put it in one place, and then allow people to access your web page and use that centralized information. This will decrease the load on the system in terms of the number of calls required to find each dose, and it will get this information out in a much more scalable fashion. And I thought, well, it's easy to criticize, you know, the rest of the world for not doing things well, and just tweeting, "I've got a brilliant idea," doesn't really produce any value. I said, I understand that if you are I had in my head an image of, like, the right person to do this is like a 24-year-old with some tech industry experience and some time on their hands. I was a 24-year-old once. I know what I would have said. I would have said, well, what if that web page blows up in a good way and tens of thousands of people are accessing it? My server bill might be more money than I've ever seen in my life. I'm no longer a 24-year-old. And I've worked in the tech industry for a number of years. And I said, if you get a $10,000 server bill as a result of being outrageously successful in helping the people of California, let me know about it. I will make it go away. And I thought, well, okay, that's done with. And then a gentleman named Carl Yang took up the torch, and he invited 10 of his friends from the tech industry into Discord, a program which is better known for arranging slaying dragons than arranging life-saving medical care. And they worked overnight to start putting together the groundwork for this website. I think it was originally a spreadsheet, and then launched the next morning just in time to start calling pharmacies and hospitals across the state of California to ask them, do you have the shot and could a 75-year-old get it today? And Carl mentioned, of course, on Twitter that he had created this Discord server, and I popped my head in with the idea of just saying, oh, I'm very glad you people are helping with this. Let me know if I can do anything to be helpful. And then one thing led to another. I got a little bit more involved than that. And I think that was a Thursday. By the time the weekend was rolling around, we saw the graph of how many people were accessing it. And we had anecdotal reports of people successfully using the information to actually get an appointment and then close the loop by actually having the patient receive their vaccine. And I had a heart-to-heart with the other 10-ish organizers and said, look, I think we all just joined this as sort of like a hackathon project, but this is very clearly, we have the chance of creating critical public health infrastructure, in which case we should not go back to our day jobs on Monday, and someone needs to lead this thing. I wish there was an obvious executive around this table to pass that off to. There isn't. I recommend you make that me, and I recommend you tell me to immediately go to the tech industry and start raising millions of dollars to pay people reasonable salaries and to pay for reasonable expenses like the call centers we're certainly going to need. And then we do this until we no longer need to do it. And after a bunch of pairwise discussions, the team said, all right, let's do it. And so we were off into the races and ran that initiative for about 6 months until we, we can talk about exactly the reasons why it closed down in 6 months as opposed to 7 or 8, but it comes down to partly accomplishing the mission or being perceived as partly accomplishing the mission and partly due to fundraising failures, but we can talk about that later. We achieved substantial success. The reason anyone in the United States of America was able to Google the vaccine was Google was able to rely on us for the information. We partnered directly with the government of the state of California. Many of the county governments in California partnered on some level of direct or indirect with the official CDC Blessed Initiative for the United States of America. And by the end of it, we're tracking 75,000 plus locations across the country with pins on the map and detailed information about vaccine eligibility and how you would get an appointment at every one of them, which again, we were redistributing to the largest publishers in the world.
Yeah, incredible achievement really for a bunch of, dare I say it, so, largely amateurs from the realm of, let's say, public health infrastructure. You guys are...
Yeah, from just thinking about the people that we had attached as employees and sort of core volunteers on the project, I think there was one person with material policy experience who had worked in the Obama White House on an entirely different thing, and perhaps two people who had had some experience with doing public health infrastructure at scale, but from a different, well, health infrastructure at scale, but a very different view of public health. Nobody had epidemiology experience. Nobody had health, you know, direct provision of healthcare experience. Nobody had a PhD in this topic. And I joke sometimes that we were rank amateurs. Well, you can, you know, we're tech professionals. Scaling systems is kind of what we do. But from the perspective of this exact thing, I think many important societal institutions would look at exactly the roster that solved this problem and say, wait, no, that is not who we would have allocated to the problem.
Hmm. So there were many, and again, go check out your account or Patrick's account, but many, let's say charitably insane policy decisions made that ultimately resulted in many people dying. As a result of limiting vaccine availability and various other restrictions that were counterproductive or unnecessary, that perhaps, as far as I'm aware, you know, nobody's ever really been held accountable for either formally or informally via, you know, press and media discussion, broader societal, hey, what happened there? And that's a whole topic in and of itself. But I'm keen to just focus on the state capacity side. So I've got a few quotes from you that I'd like to read out. So the first one, we have a titanic gap in state capacity. The largest and most well-resourced organizations in the world, and thinking here of the U.S. government, the state of California, and so on, did not conceive of, approve, and immediately execute an obvious and largely successful operational plan that non-specialists were able to draw up on Discord in a matter of hours. And implicit here is, and discussed elsewhere in the piece, is that they actually spent hundreds of millions of dollars doing ineffective substitutes instead. So what happened there? It, you know, we reach out to some sort of provider that's already been pre-approved to try and do something quickly, spend tens of millions of dollars putting something together that is ultimately completely unsuccessful compared to what you guys were managed to do overnight. How could this be so?
It's worth saying that the obvious plan here is very not magic. There is no high technology involved. We are building the world's least impressive inventory tracking system. And our proof of concept for that tracking system worked was I literally got on the phone to the there exists a Walgreens at the corner of 4th Street and King Street in San Francisco. I'm aware that Walgreens exist because I had previously been to San Francisco on business. And, you know, their number is in the phone book or on Google. And I called them up, and I can recite almost verbatim exactly the way that call goes. Blah, 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 blah. Press 4 to speak to the pharmacist. Hit 4. Hello, this is Walgreens. Hello. Could a 75-year-old individual get the COVID vaccine from you today? No, we don't have it. Check back in 2 weeks. Thank you very much. Click. And now, like, the fact of that phone call has proven that all you need to do is make tens of thousands of phone calls. And it is not beyond the capability of society to make tens of thousands of phone calls. We have call centers available that can scale that straight to the moon. It's strictly a math problem after that point. And then given the capability of making that phone call tens of thousands of times, you just write down who says yes and then publish it in any fashion to the internet. Honestly, I would have been very supportive of not merely publishing it to the internet, but there was a substantial amount of societal goodwill that government had in the moment for, you know, breaking the back of the COVID epidemic. And if the government had just used suasion with places like the Nightly News and said, we would really appreciate if for 3 minutes on the Nightly News every day until we don't need this anymore, you can just read out the places that have the COVID vaccine available, that would have been hugely impactful for exactly the demographic, older folks that might not have internet access, might feel a bit of a digital divide, et cetera, that most needed the vaccine as of January, February, March of 2021. But what do we do instead? So there's often a narrative of tech solutionism where, you engineers think everything can be solved by software, but the real world is complicated, et cetera, et cetera. And that narrative mispredicts what actually happened here. The government policymakers were saying, we think that this is just a matter of there are multiple parallel distribution paths for this vaccine. Each of them is recorded in a separate database somewhere. We need a vendor to go out and make a system that will make all the databases talk to each other, use an API or something, maybe put it on a blockchain, I don't know. And then after all the databases talk to each other, all of this mess is solved. And the technologist said, we don't want to negotiate an API with all of the various supply chains that might have access to the vaccine right now. We can't even get an authoritative list of all those supply chains. We just know that this must be administered in the physical universe at addresses that exist in the phone book. Each of them has a phone number attached to it. The simplest thing that works is call that phone number and ask the highly paid responsible medical professional who sits next to that phone all day, because that is their job, whether they have the vaccine or not. And that's another, like, this is a critical thing to take official notice of. If a database says that Walgreens at 4th and King doesn't have the vaccine, and the pharmacist at Walgreens at 4th and King says, yes, I have the vaccine, I have my physical hand on the vial, the pharmacist is always right, and the database is always wrong. And for seeing like estate reasons, the government often wanted to track towards databases or track towards spreadsheets versus tracking towards material reality. A spreadsheet can't inject anyone with life-saving medication. The pharmacist can. We should prefer what the pharmacist says. And so one explicit example of where the spreadsheet diverges from reality is so the state of California, in its infinite wisdom, was sending allocations of the vaccine to any number of medical providers, including the various University of California healthcare systems. And for people who are not familiar with the state of California, the University of California at name a city here is a large healthcare system which might have dozens of physical locations. It might have only one row in the spreadsheet, though, for a facility that healthcare is probably not actually conducted at. It's just their central warehouse, and they receive many things at the central warehouse: saline water, scalpels, radiological supplies, and the vaccine. And then they put it on trucks or in vans to all of the, 45 places where they actually conduct the delivery of healthcare. And those might be quite far from the central warehouse, could be in a different county even. And so the state of California institutionally believed that we can only expose availability of the vaccine in this location, the central warehouse, where the vaccine is not actually available to any healthcare seeker. And we said, no, the actual place that healthcare is delivered is these 45 locations that your spreadsheet does not know exist, but that we do. We have called them, and here are the subset of that 45 that actually have it available. And I felt a little bit of frustration as a software engineer who has no reason to understand, how the University of California healthcare system at City X conducts healthcare delivery. Why am I explaining this to public health officials? Why don't they already know this? But we often found ourselves in that sort of situation.
So one of the things that's often criticized about government procurement, and delivery of software in particular, is this waterfall process. And mm-hmm. I'm going to put something out there. So it sounds to me as if your process was something like, here's a reasonable idea, doing this simply. The capacity of call centers is massive compared to the amount of calling we're going to need to do. And I think we could put something up reasonably quickly and iterate from there. The alternative approach is somebody had an idea that there was some solution out there associated with databases and APIs, and then so wrote up an enormous amount of procurement documentation and so on about that, and then everything that all of the failures subsequently are sort of downstream of that decision, because there's no capacity to revisit that, because perhaps mm-hmm. it was made at the federal level. President Biden's busy and he's got a million things to do, and there's no capacity anywhere further on down the chain to kind of go, hold on, this isn't working. We need to be rethinking our approach here. Would that be a sort of a fair summary, do you think?
I think that's broadly fair. And I will give the government officials some grace here in that they were busy, they had many things on their mind, et cetera, et cetera. But if I can give like some explicit examples of shortcuts that we made. So we decided, we as a society decided, okay, we are constrained by the RFP process. We need to get vendors who know what they're doing into this. And what often happened was, well, we don't want to spin up an entirely new vendor relationship because that will take 18 months to deliver the one software solution that will solve all these database problems. So instead, we're going to repurpose vendor relationships and repurpose software that already exists. And we can talk about specific negative consequences of that. But one thing that happened was Castlight Health had had a contract for having the United States vaccine availability database for routine, largely influenza vaccinations for 10 plus years. And they said, great, we already have a vendor. This will cut out so much paperwork. We're going to use them for the COVID thing as well at the federal level. But there were some technical consequences of that decision that reflected into the future in ways that were acutely negative for Americans' ability to access the COVID vaccine, where the trade-off made sense in 2012 when it was just the annual flu shot, which obviously there are lives riding on the annual flu shot, but it wasn't the, you know, stopping the entire economy on a dime issue that COVID was. And there would have been political will to change those decisions had anyone ever explicitly brought up that decision as like, this is a thing that senior decision makers need to make a call on behalf of the American people. But some combination of, you know, this being covered by multiple layers of bureaucracy and some combination of just we have such bad experiences in Washington with doing software projects that we only do them through the approved vendors and then we throw them under the bus if anything goes wrong, resulted in no one making what I feel was a very obviously correct call with respect to particular subparts of that.
So on that note, actually brings us nicely to the second quote that I have here. The United States of America can be decisive and effective. It knows this. It teaches case studies about its ability to be decisive and effective in its history classes. The existence of history classes is itself evidence of decisive, effective action. But we chose not to be decisive and effective because it believes itself incapable of simple things. So, and this is one such example you were talking about earlier, websites. It believes itself incapable of doing it, so it chooses not to be. It's quite an interesting formulation you have there as well, that it chooses not to be decisive and effective despite knowing that it can be. Can you unpack that a little bit for us?
Yeah. The single issue that I think most causes the American government's distrust of software as a way to cause its goals to happen in the world was the rollout of the healthcare.gov nationwide marketplace for, well, not nationwide, very broad marketplace for delivery of insurance services under the Affordable Care Act, which was during the Obama administration. It's sometimes called
Obamacare.
Obamacare. But the relevant people in D.C. hate when you call it that. Well, on one side of the aisle, they hate when you call it that. The other side of the aisle, anyhow, politics. I'll stick to what I know. The received wisdom in D.C. is that you could be a well-loved president and have your signature initiative and legacy tarnished by the engineer's failure to launch a good project and therefore never be in the position where you are taking technical risk as the government. This dominates thinking about a lot of software projects, including ones which were directly implicated here. I have a lot of respect for the team that ended up running the website vaccines.gov. Vaccines.gov received staff augmentation from the Digital Services Agency, and the Digital Services Agency was very clearly given the brief, and you can see the consequences of this in their formal write-up of it. President Biden is going to get on the nightly news, and he is going to announce the existence of a website. We know what happens when presidents read a URL on the nightly news. It crashes, and then they look terrible. You will make sure that President Biden does not look terrible when the website crashes. That is, like, the number one operating principle. And staff all of your engineers on scaling this website to the absolute moon. And the engineers did what they were ordered to do, which is... Again, I have immense respect for this team. I have immense respect for the people at the DSA. That is a misread of the likely impact of the president reading a URL on the nightly news. There was, in fact, no reasonable expectation that there would be a standing wave of traffic against this when there was a standing wave of traffic against the healthcare.gov website back in the day. And the misallocation of resources there causes cognizable harm to the people that the policy was intended to implement, and also caused a delay of probably weeks in delivery of that website, and also a delay of weeks in other organizations doing their own thing to impact the initiative, because many of us found ourselves thinking, well, we need to be in the room where it happens, and we need to not upstage the federal government, and we are getting signals from partners in, say, the White House it would be a bad idea if you were to scoop President Biden on the existence of a nationwide website here. And so VaccinateCA, for our part, we did not launch our national site publicly until a minute after President Biden got up to the podium to speak about the government's national website. And that's our decision, I think. I will take ownership of it and made for reasons, but those delays were not necessary. If we made better policy choices, we could have made better choices as a nation to bring more appropriate resources to bear earlier there.
So when you say better choices and better policy choices, there was a statement you made during that answer as well that maybe the concerns that were irrelevant, maybe because of likes of Cloudflare and Edge, you know, Edge Cloud and so on, that's just those sorts of concerns are less relevant than they were during Obamacare? Or?
Without going deep into the technical weeds here, the thing that made healthcare.gov difficult is that it was a single website that was interfacing with many, many dozens of different providers and databases and doing write heavy load and needing to fan out this information to places like the Social Security Administration and the IRS and coalesce their information back from them and do this on a user per user basis, because everyone has their own insurance policy. They don't share their insurance policy with every other American. Finding the vaccines, on the other hand, is not a rate-heavy load at all. It's a read load. You just need to get the same list some subset of the same list that everyone gets. The website doesn't need to know your identity at all, because you're going to be calling Walgreens as your next step. That scales to the absolute moon. You could service the entire nation off of a server that costs $2 a month from Amazon. You probably wouldn't do that, but directionally, that's the amount of engineering work required. Not 20 people drop everything for 6 weeks to, implement a caching strategy and a thorough engineering architecture work here, which wasn't needed during the healthcare.gov rescue situation.
Sure. So the general model, just coming back to it. What we were talking about before, where you've got the sort of waterfall of there's a high level decision that's made about an architecture, or do not let this website crash or what have you, oftentimes based on generations of scar tissue that you and I talked about last time we spoke, and then from there everything is just downstream, which perhaps when you're talking about designing and building a bridge, and you want some degree of repeatability, that, we've done this 100 times before, we want to be able to just do that again, and setting those requirements and the scope of those requirements is unlikely to change dramatically as the project is delivered. Whereas it almost seems uniquely terrible approach when it comes to delivering software, because the solution might be completely you might discover after 5 minutes that it's completely ineffective, it's going to take forever and so on and so forth, but you're locked in at that stage. Mm-hmm. Vendors aren't particularly interested in necessarily telling you this, because they quote a price and they get paid. So mm-hmm.
And to repeat something that my buddy Dave Guarino has said on a number of occasions, in the software industry, we assume that 10% of the work happens before you launch the website, and then 90% of the work happens as you evolve the website in response to requirements that you learn as you operate it. But in government contracting, it's the opposite. We expect 90% of the work to be done in the waterfall, write all the test cases, write all the requirements documents, deliver exactly the thing that is required, and then reserve 10% of the total budget for operating. But you essentially cannot make any changes afterwards without a signed change order and another 18 months of rigmarole.
Yeah, and makes sense for a bridge. Yeah,
makes sense for a bridge. you don't want to change the number of levels of the bridge after your first 2 months of operating it, but you do want to have contact with reality on the exact problem we were dealing with in, say, January with respect to the vaccination effort is, the demographics which are most affected, et cetera, and our guesses as to how they will interact with the site will not match what we know when, for example, by May, in many places in the nation, we are no longer supply constrained. The operational focus should switch from rationing and doling this out to the appropriate people to attempting to go for, make this process as easy to get through as possible. But if you've, pre-committed a year earlier, we're going to need a rationing system on day one, deliver me a rationing system, then you will, like the state of California actually did, spend tens of millions of dollars getting consultancies to write rationing systems. And we mentioned I want to both be polite about the fact and be honest about it. We, the United States of America, through our elected representatives and through civil servants who represent our interests, committed monstrous crimes in 2021, which are against the laws, traditions, and constitution of the United States of America, including aggressively redlining the provision of life-saving medical care in a way which was designed to cause racially discriminatory outcomes with the provision of medical care. Just throwing that out there as a statement.
With that caveat.
One of the things that we spent tens of millions of dollars on was that we want your consultancy to write a website which will enforce residency restrictions. And a residency restriction is essentially, when we are under a supply constraint, there must be some method to, decide some people get it and some people don't. And we have, in our infinite wisdom as the government, decided that equity is one primary thing that we are focusing on. And a thing that we think would be contrary to equity is allowing anyone who shows up at the clinic to receive the life-saving medication. The thing that we are specifically worried about is relatively well-resourced people from advantaged demographics will use their superior access to transportation and information to travel to clinics which have the vaccine available and take that instead of that vaccine being used by someone in the local community who intend the vaccine to go to. And so therefore, to get an appointment to go to the vaccine, you will need to go to the county's website, which is delivered by Accenture or similar, and prove to the website that you reside within one of the zip codes that we have allocated for those vaccine doses. And only then will you get the ticket, virtual or otherwise, which allows you to go to the pharmacy and get the vaccine. We spent tens of millions of dollars on that, targeting essentially a four-month window where we were acutely supply constrained. But we did not turn off residency restrictions on the websites after that four-month window because we physically had no way to do that because that was not in the bid documents in some cases. And so there were...
Not only that, but the governor went on television and said, anybody that skips the queue will be prosecuted. Any doctor that skips the queue will be prosecuted.
And we will prosecute you. We will be aggressive about going after the reputational impacts to you, your institutions, and your licenses. That is virtually a verbatim quote from a governor.
So the consequence of this is you've got supply-constrained vaccine. You redline, say you can only be in this. You defrost a bunch of vaccines in the morning. Not enough people show up that particular day, and so you throw them out because risking even saving people's lives is not worth the risk of having your institution shut down and thus many, many, many more people dying. It's like absurd,
absolutely the theater of the absurd. And I really want us to remember institutionally that this happened. There is a New York Times article which documents an actual prosecution of a Texas family doctor for shoplifting because the the medical reality slash regulatory reality of these vaccines is they, quote unquote, go bad after 12 hours. The physical reality is slightly different, but the paperwork says what it says. So if you have 5, 8, or 10 doses in a vial and you have 3 doses which have not been injected close to the end of the business day at your place of employment, either they go in the trash or they go to somebody. There was a doctor in Texas who made, I think, above and beyond efforts to find someone to receive the vaccine, couldn't find anyone, didn't want to throw it in the trash, and then administered it to his wife, I believe. And he was prosecuted for shoplifting. At risk of losing his medical license, et cetera, et cetera. And the chilling effect of that was very real. When the governor got on the nightly news and said, we will end your medical institution if you enable anyone to skip the line, what a lot of pharmacies heard was, we could keep an end-of-day shots list. We could keep a list by the phone of people to call just in case nobody came in for the last 2, 3, 5 doses. We could extend life-saving medical care to them. However, we've been told that that will result not just in some consequences with regards to our vaccine ability, but that will result in this pharmacy, which administers thousands of drugs for thousands of conditions, many of which are, you know, critical to people's lives and welfare. We will be shut down. And so, okay, we will not risk that over one drug for one condition for a few patients. We would rather – and I don't want to throw the pharmacy under the bus for the following decision, but it's important to understand that the Unites of America made this decision. We would rather people die than violate the sanctity of this tiering system. And that was the wrong decision to make. And we made it with our eyes open. And we should seriously think about what madness led us to make that decision. And before even, you know, thinking about what madness led us to make that decision, I would love if we could openly acknowledge that we made that decision, but for very frustrating reasons about the U.S. polity, no one is very interested in having that that discussion. Sorry, I'm obviously passionate and frustrated about this, but we did make that decision. There are people who are no longer with us as a result of this, and I feel we owe it to ourselves, we owe it to history, and we, not to put too fine a point on it, owe it to the dead to be honest about what we did and for the purpose of doing this better the next time. If, God willing, we never see a respiratory pandemic again in our lifetimes, but if it happens again, we must do better.
Yeah. Absolutely. This is... I want to just take one part of that because it's obviously an enormous topic and many, like I said at the start, you know, I think it deserves a lot more discussion. But just to take one small part of it, the decision that was made around this particular policy decision that then led to the development of a software package that then was locked in place. I think one of the things that is becoming increasingly clear to me is the idea that, again, unlike perhaps a bridge where, you know, there's a business case process perhaps and we've identified the need for a bridge. And once that's the case and we go into design and build and so on, we're not rethinking the nature of the transportation network that bridge is associated with, and reasonably enough. Whereas when it comes to software, I think what's often missed is this idea that it's like, okay, well, software is some component, like you're buying a thing off, whether it's a large capital expense or a small one, it's something that you're buying off a shelf like a consumer product, rather than simply the information layer of a much, like the implementation of policy and process. And so if you're thinking about software or delivering a software, really it needs to be incorporated into the whole thinking of policy and process, right? And if you're – so as you're developing this thing, whether it's a small-scale, relatively straightforward piece or something significant, it needs to be thought of in – to needs the in the scope of the project needs to be what policy decisions have been made here? Are they still appropriate? Is the process that we're attempting to digitize here actually still relevant? And then perhaps it you know, even if that policy decision we're acknowledging is terrible, if we've got more of a flexible approach, then at the very least, when that finally changes, we're in a position maybe to update the way that we're actually implementing it.
Mm-hmm. Software is certainly not a replacement for good policy. It's a complement to it, and it should be developed in the knowledge that policy can change and software can change, and perhaps we should cause those changes to be mutually reflective of each other. There were some bright spots during the 2021 vaccination campaign where those infelicities that we have baked into software due to our RFP and similar process for procuring it were worked around by people at, say, the ground level. So one thing that happened routinely when VaccinateCA would call up pharmacists is say, officially, a person like the one you just described cannot get the vaccine today because officially the county says we are still at stage 2C, for example. However, unofficially, I do have doses available. And so what you should tell people is tell whatever lie is required to get the county's website to issue you an appointment. Come in for the appointment. I will not verify any of the information that is on your appointment card. I will administer life-saving medication to anyone who comes in for it. And I feel a tremendous we owe a tremendous debt to people who put their lives, their professional reputations, their licenses, their careers on the line to say, I understand there are rules, and I understand I swore an oath, and where they conflict, I will favor the oath. Sorry, I get a little emotional about this. That ended up as a patch, essentially, over software, which could not change on the day-to-day, week-to-week basis that policy was changing at. I also think, there were so many infelicities with regards to how we communicated policy. The government, frequently at the state level and county levels, could not agree with itself. Not merely the state disagreed with counties, but like the county would disagree with itself as to what the policy was and had no channel for getting it out to the implicated individuals at, say, pharmacies. And so we heard from pharmacists very frequently that there is no blessed channel for us hearing what state, where on the flowchart are we as of today from the state of California? I learned that if I happen to Google it or see it in my Twitter feed, but it's not like I get an update every day from the county health department on move to 1C, we've passed yada yada in terms of our metrics. And so a thing that VaccinateCA very seriously considered doing for a minute was arranging to FedEx copies of local California newspapers to, we will FedEx you a copy of yesterday's newspaper so that you can learn what the policy was yesterday, so you don't learn what the policy yesterday was in 2 weeks when someone tells it to you around a watering hole. But given that one has abundant state capacity, and goodness, I hope we can arrange to have state capacity in the future, you could simply, making phone calls to pharmacists is not an unsolved problem in material science. The state of California could have arranged to every day, start the morning with a cup of coffee and a phone call to every pharmacist in the state of California. Dr. Smith, thank you very much for your service. Just letting you know, you're in Modesto County, and the county says that it is on phase 2C today. Do you have any comments that you need to give back to the county or anything that has been preventing the vaccination effort? Okay, talk to you tomorrow. A buddy of mine, Dave Kasten, who was a volunteer on VaccinateCA, made a comment to me which has stuck with me for the last few years. He said, we have the National Guard available in the United States for a governor to say, my state is under a state of emergency. Could be armed insurrection, could be a wildfire. And I have the authority as the governor to get 40,000 people in a room and put your machine gun on that side of the room. Now pick up this telephone and start making phone calls. And we simply did not choose to order them to make phone calls. But had we done so, we could have had, you know, National Guard or reservist or similar backfill for any constrained part of the edifice that is the state of California.
But money was never a problem anyway, right? Like there's call centers everywhere that had 1,000 times the capacity that would have been required for this. And
yeah, the right scale to think of is like a single high school class, if you had allowed them to make phone calls 8 hours a day, could have made phone calls for the entire state of California. There are call centers which could not take that business because it is too small for them to contemplate. Mind-boggling. We spent $400,000 or so on call center services over the course of 6 months, which is tiddlywinks by the standards of the budget of the state of California.
Right. Interesting, you raise the example of utilizing the National Guard. There's a final quote that I have from your article about making use of this sort of capability. And it's the idea of the state government giving a call to the likes of Apple, Amazon, Google. Mm-hmm. "You seem to employ many of America's best experts in software, logistics, and marketing. I think it would be salutary if you put your very best people on solving this problem for America immediately. I think you could probably have an initial proposal ready by tomorrow. If you think you would need to demonstrate moral authority or gain cooperation from any arm of government, you can put your project leader in a U.S. Army colonel's uniform and give him a piece of paper saying, 'Do it, because the president says so.' Well, you can't do that, but I absolutely can and will. Does this sound reasonable to you?" It's a capability that was made use of extensively during World War II, mm-hmm. that we could have utilized again, that presumably the companies involved they were unwilling to be involved informally without the sort of blessing of institutions, but to give them a colonel's uniform. Let's say, and employ them in that way and pay them a salary of the contract of a dollar, I think many would have jumped at the opportunity or the call to serve, but we didn't do it.
I think a lot were not so much waiting for the call to serve as waiting for permission / blessing, as you just alluded to. As I mentioned in the story of Vaccinate CA piece, there was a real worry in the tech industry that causing the government to look ineffective in early 2021 would be held against them and their core businesses due to the political implications of the wake of the January 6th events and similar. And as a result of that, the call went out in the tech industry widely by government relations teams and PR teams saying, "Don't get in the newspaper under any circumstances. We are putting our heads down." And I believe that directly conflicted with the ability of public health teams at the tech companies, which, by the way, that's a real thing. There are 200 people at Google who work in the health department. But those teams were told to stand down on a variety of projects. I'm constrained a little about what I can say about things because obviously we made our partners in government and our partners in the tech industry some representations, and I don't want to cause anyone career damage by backing out of those handshake agreements. But I will throw out there that I'm aware of one major American software company they essentially had the project plan for Vaccinate CA written up internally. And you know, the default state of any project plan is to go up to middle management and then not achieve activation energy. And they simply didn't achieve activation energy. But if you had tapped them on the shoulder and said, "Good news, your country needs you," I think there, you know, we would have had a better chance of achieving that activation energy. And indeed, we were notoriously in the last few years tapping tech companies on the shoulder and saying, "The national government has some policy priorities and you should get aligned with them right now." I think we can discuss some of those policy priorities in another podcast. But if we know we have the capability and we know there are a lot of lives on the line, perhaps we should use that capability in service of something where the laws, constitution, traditions, moral sentiment to the United States of America is like broadly in favor of us doing that, instead of using it for invidious ends or unimportant ends. I will mention for completeness that the statutory authority that allows the president to just like pop a uniform on somebody and say, you're it. We've rediscovered that. So apparently some, I believe the CTO of Palantir got a uniform in the recent past. And so the law is definitely still on the books. I'll take no position as to whether, you know, the current administration is succeeding with its goals with regards to that uniform grant, but we can do it any time.
Yeah. I guess one of the risks, though, that I mean, you and I discussed in sitting down on the bench in Lighthaven, though, was if you're in a situation where there's a declining or increasing partisanship and a declining respect for the rule of law, let's say, and that, again, that may be a topic for another podcast, but in this situation, yes, Palantir is very clearly softly or informally politically aligned, should we say, with the Trump administration, and so is willing to take that risk, let's say, of a change in administration and potential prosecutions arriving for that CTO. But one of the perhaps underappreciated consequences of this sort of world that we're moving into is the much higher degree of risk that individuals would face compared to, let's say, World War II when DuPont was involved and did a massive amount of work for the Manhattan Project for a single dollar and was happy to take on that. If you're in a position where every single time you've been asked to make that call of duty, that you think, well, gosh, what's the risk in it for me, then makes it a lot more difficult to achieve those sort of results.
I hear that, and I do acknowledge that the United States is in a period of, a great amount of partisan disagreement, and that sometimes that partisan disagreement is communicated in ways that are, let's say, high temperature. However, I think, we professionals who work in the tech industry or work in government should be rational with regards to the amount of risk that has been taken. And I've made the allegation that we, as a society, through our healthcare system, through the government, committed massive, morally monstrous crimes. And the total number of prosecutions with respect to those crimes is zero. And therefore, what is the real risk that a senior Google project manager whose job was setting up a database for a few weeks would find their tax return audited by the IRS? I think that risk is, one, minuscule. And two, like, allow people or corporations to run their risk analysis and see whether it's within their tolerance or not. Three, we have options as the government if we want to make someone like durably immune to prosecution for official acts. Say what you will about the rule of law, and goodness, I'm greatly in favor of it, and I hope it continues. But we can change laws. We can write pardons. We can et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, if this is important to us. And so, I don't think we should catastrophize about the likelihood of, if the tech industry does things which are aligned with the interests of administration, 49, then administration 50 might prosecute individual tech industry executives.
Cry from that yet, let's hope.
Yep. And I have a lot of faith in the American system of government and in our judicial system and in the Constitution, and some impaired faith with regards to norms over the course of the last few years. But we are talking about well-resourced, relatively powerful individuals. Speaking only for myself, I was willing to leave my family for 6 months during the middle of the pandemic to travel to California to run the Vaccinate CA initiative. Would I also have been willing to what's the phrase people use? Catch a case over it? Yeah, sure. I will hire a lawyer. I'd be happy to show up in a court of competent jurisdiction this year and say, you know, I'm going to assert privilege under the First Amendment for publishing true things about publicly available information. And indeed, I made that argument to other people at VaccinateCA that were worried, what if we embarrass the state of California by saying true things about their policies? And I said, well, we're a very specialized newspaper publishing true facts about the COVID vaccine, and newspapers are all but inviolate in the United States of America. We have the First Amendment and very subtle jurisprudence here. And I think that argument will carry the day 100 times out of 100.
So one of the things that's interested me is the dynamics of civic hackathons, of which you could say VaccinateCA in a particularly successful one. My experience is that they're often filled with great people and a lot of enthusiasm and technical expertise, but that they're perhaps too low context of the situation within, let's say, a city hall or what have you, to make significant impact. Part of that might be because of the sort of non-integration with requirements and process and policy changes. But I guess the question I have for you is, how do we recreate VaccinateCA on demand or a similar institution or failing some complete answer to that question, how would we make it easier next time for such a thing to arise?
So I'll say it's the strength of the system and nation that we were allowed to do it as an informal effort and then to snowball our success from the informal effort to get some level of institutional legitimacy and then be able to partner with government and larger non-governmental institutions like, say, Google. It would have been a lot faster if we had been a skunkworks project within any part of the American civic system or a skunkworks project within a large tech corporation. And the tech corporations had their own reasons for not approving skunkworks projects of that nature. And so, like, there's one micro patch that you can make. Like, simply heal the wounds that exist between the tech industry and the government and other centers of power in the United States and cause them to be willing to do things again. You know, the Digital Services Agency, which has been rebranded recently, I hear, and other initiatives have been attempting to make government more nimble about delivery of technical services over the last couple of years in the United States. And there's no reason in principle that a project very like VaccinateCA couldn't have been run out of the DSA directly or run out of the California Governor's Office or run out of the California National Guard or similar. And so I think on one level, it's a simple question of will, and I call it the will to have nice things. You know, an awareness that we do have state capacity when we want to, like, when, when America decides to do something, we really do it. And so we should just decide to have nice things in some places. I think it's a bit of a question of making policy decision makers more aware of things that they are already capable of. So dispel that UGG field that we have around software. Get some people who are more software adjacent or internet native into positions of authority, not merely that they, you know, use Signal for discussing war plans. I'm sorry, that was an aside, but like some awareness of the fact that websites are not, in fact, you know, the moon landing in terms of technical difficulty, then okay, what? Like, what falls out from that? Like, is this a problem shaped such that we just need to publish a website is actually responsive to the needs here? And VaccinateCA was in material part, not a website. It's a website and a calling operation. But, like, neither of those is an unsolved problem in management science. So those are the bigger things. With respect to getting uninvolved technologists more aware of how politics is conducted, one is, you know, increasing interconnectivity in places like this space, statecraft, et cetera, you know, make people aware of each other on the internet. One which I wish we did more of was simply have engineers watch people do work in government and note what they see. A thing which Stripe does not endorse the following, but I will give this because I think it is instructive. much operational software in the financial industry is very broken, and it causes the teams that are in charge of operations to have a very poor experience of their lives and jobs, and causes mistakes. And so one canonical example of this is the Revlon bond at Citibank, which caused a team of three people in a particular part of the Citibank edifice to wire out $1 billion of the bank's capital because the software that they were physically clicking on did not make it obvious that they were wiring out $1 billion of the bank's capital. And so I watched a discussion happen between two senior decision makers at Stripe, and from the top of IT, the view was, well, good thing that could never happen here because our operational software is excellent. And the head of ops said something which rounded to, well, I can think of three places where it isn't excellent immediately, bang, bang, bang. And the head of IT, like, face goes white like a sheet, and he said, why am I hearing about this now? Why haven't you been screaming that from the rooftops for the last couple of years? That sounds like something we could get one engineer to fix in like 3 hours. And the head of ops said, well, I've been working ops in the financial industry for a long career at this point, and I've never had software which isn't broken. So I've learned that all software is broken all the time, and ops just has to roll with that. And being a relatively new employee here, I'm obviously not going to incinerate my political capital asking for crazy concessions like software that works. And so, you know, heal all the wounds of the world is small step. But, you know, we have to have a culture of understanding that we can actually ship products that work into the world and then, you know, reacclimate to we should expect when you join a new organization in the government that you get issued a laptop on the first day and that your laptop boots up in, you know, 5 seconds and not 30 minutes. And Dave Kasten, a buddy of mine, often says, you know, you learn early and often in government that everything is broken. All your technical systems are broken all the time. That's just the default state of them, and you work around that. And so your laptop takes 30 minutes to boot up in the morning because it's loading Citrix environments and blah, 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 and that just is the way it is. And we can't accept that. And, you know, there's some combination of regulation, some combination of legislation, some combination of vendor management, et cetera, that causes your laptop to work the way that every laptop does in Silicon Valley. Because they're physically the same laptops, guys. Like, this is a choice. Like, let's choose to not be broken.
Mm. So one of the things you've said previously was that government software, and I guess in this case hardware and the interface, the procurement usually has a paper trail carefully attesting that it is neither a graft nor waste, which receives far more intellectual effort than the shipping of the software product itself does, that the optimal levels of fraud is not zero. Paperwork trail makes the project rigid and unable to learn and adapt as it goes. So is this like a fact of life that we just simply, I don't know. What I'm trying to say here is I think anybody with any sense would agree with the statement that you've just made. There's been a lot of great books over the last 5-10 years about how we are failing at the way we're doing things with respect to software development and procurement in the public sector. And yet, whenever I read them, I think to myself, gosh, there's a very complex web of incentives. And, you know, we talked about scar tissue and so on here that makes the proposed solutions much more difficult in practice than you might think. The various mm-hmm. forms of risk avoidance and so on that a private sector employee that's responsible for their bottom line, let's say, you know, within their business unit, just simply doesn't face. Mm-hmm. You know, the public sector employees have very little exposure to upside risk and extreme exposure to downside risk. So as long as we can continue to make sure that, you know, I can't be blamed because I've mm-hmm. done all the process right. So there's this very great incentive towards this continuing, but I you seem quite optimistic, and I just wondered, do you had any comment on that?
I think we can certainly do tinkering around the margins. One of the most useful things for senior decision makers in the United States to have counterfactually done in 2021 was get on the nightly news and say, you know, we're in a state of emergency. I have legitimate authority granted by the voters to express to you the moral sentiment of the American government on behalf of the American people. My expression is that the overriding priority is saving lives via effectively administering healthcare and not paperworking things. And so if you are ever in a position where there is a conflict between saving lives and paperworking things, I would like you to choose to save a life. And if you need specific guidance or specific authority or similar, talk to your usual partners in government. And I want those usual partners to hear the same message and use any authority available to you under statute or otherwise to fix things here. I think without changing any regulation anywhere, simply that it's not even a grant of authority. It's just a statement of principles. Could have done something in an emergency situation. We could consider doing formal grants of authority. We could consider going to, you know, the usual binders of regulations for things and saying, okay, we're going to do a carve-out for the binders upon binders right now. In fact, we're, you know, passing, like, we don't have enough binders. We're going to put one more binder of carve-outs available. And that binder will be one, if, you know, there's a presidential finding of blah, 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 then you get to bypass things. Two, if blah, 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 bypass things. Three, blah, 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 bypass things. And perhaps that's something that policy people might be willing to explore. Perhaps this is something that, 19 out of 20 departments will not get comfortable with, but we can generate some evidence of, you know, outstanding success in department number 20 and then socialize it over a period of decades. Because I don't think we got into the situation over 1 week or 1 month or one administration. I think we've backed into the civilization over decades of our operation of the government, and fixing it will likely take a while. And so, you know, you should put in the hard yards of doing that. Policy work and rationalization of existing policies. I understand that there are people who have devoted their entire career to this, and I understand that many of them end up I don't know if cynical is quite the right word or burned out is quite the right word, but you are up against a hard problem for your entire professional career. I will say on behalf of those of us who work in private industry, I also had a compliance department. There are all sorts of things that I would like to do that are illegal. Shucks. Well, what things that I want to do are legal, and then do more of those things expose myself to the upside of like doing things in the world. And again, I think when we allow ourselves to have a will to do wonderful things that are productive in government, we frequently discover the capability of doing wonderful and productive things. So we should be aware that that is possible and pursue it with some vigor.
Right. All right. We're coming towards the end of our time here. So I've got some quick fire questions and then a few predictions before I'll sadly have to let you go. Mm-hmm. You once described Twitter, prior to the Elon takeover anyway, as the message bus for the federal government, institutions, and media. Mm-hmm. Personally, I've seen it act as something of almost like a release valve, allowing messages from sort of lowly Amazon users, let's say, to reach senior bureaucrats or the chief executive in a way that perhaps the official channels don't. Is there more? Is that kind of what you're talking about, or is there more to it than that? And is the functionality still intact given the sort of, you know, schism with Blue Sky and the changes that Elon's made?
So that isn't primarily the mechanism I'm thinking about, but if I can say a few words about that mechanism, there's a concept that's called escalations in many institutions where you have a retail level user, a person who exists and requires services, who has a unsatisfactory experience with the bureaucracy and wants to get their concerns listened to by someone else. And there are ways to achieve those escalations to not just the retail-facing part of the bureaucracy, but decision makers that are higher up. One historical way to do that is engaging a lawyer. And so your lawyer talks to their lawyer, but obviously lawyers are expensive. One less expensive way is getting a local journalist to take your side of things and to call the PR department and say, it looks like you're foreclosing on Miss Mildred's house, but Miss Mildred showed me some canceled checks for her mortgage. Do you have a comment on that? And then a bank will discover very rapidly that it is capable of listening to Miss Mildred again. And this works in government, too. Obviously, there is the case that you can call up, in the United States, we call it constituent services at one's local member of Congress. And then the constituent service representative will call into the agency and say, Senator blah, 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 would very much appreciate if you could get an update to Mrs. Smith by the end of this week. If you can't get that update to Mrs. Smith, Senator blah, 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 would very much appreciate if you updated this office as to what the blocker is. Thank you very much. And Twitter is a pathway to escalations, which doesn't require you to understand that constituent services exist in the world and doesn't require you to engage a lawyer. That is a wonderful thing. But the specific thing that I am thinking of is that there are policymakers in various places of the government who have sort of formal methods of coordination and informal methods of coordination. One of those informal methods of coordination is that the sentiment of the administration is said by people who are known to be proxies in places like editorials in the New York Times. And other bureaucrats read that sentiment of the administration with respect to what the administration's core priorities are. And then they orient their own lives around that sentiment of the administration. But low-level bureaucrats, proxies, aligned individuals within civil society, et cetera, are on Twitter all the time passing these messages around. And sometimes those messages travel extremely fast on Twitter. And one that I think happened during the last administration was Elon Musk had some comments with regards to like individual flight plans of people available in some disaster relief scenario. And the Secretary of Transportation, whose name I unfortunately have never heard pronounced in
the Buttigieg.
Buttigieg. Secretary Buttigieg was like literally replying to him directly on, I don't understand that that is in fact the case, but I will look into it immediately. So, you know, fast resolution of those concerns. And also, you know, that is a signal seen by other departments on, okay, you might have thought this is a non-aligned individual and therefore do not extend them, say, the benefit of the doubt on this issue. But you are now getting someone who is obviously an aligned individual to say, oh, no, this is something where the administration's priority is very clear. We are absolutely 100% behind the disaster relief effort here and will take reasonable efforts to expedite it. I would expect that other parts of the American government seeing that in Twitter in the palm of their hand or seeing it reported in the American media were like, okay, message received, I should do that. And that's why I think it is the message bus, which is a computer science term for the same thing. You know,
sure.
One person telling many people on behalf of the system that this is our new operating model here.
I understand. So there's something similar formalized in China as well, where you've got these sort of various messages that work their way down through the system. It's a very interesting one example that you raised there. Is what would
and
be
for what
the,
it's worth, I think there have been many changes in Twitter over the course of the new management. Not all of them for the better. I shake my fist that my podcast links get deprioritized. It is still the case that many members of the American journalist class are quite tied to Twitter. It is still the case that people who want to have a career in Washington are quite tied to Twitter. It is still the case that CEOs of American tech companies are extremely, extremely aware of things that are said about their companies on Twitter. That is where the action is. I'd encourage people who are decision makers to understand like that is where the action is and take appropriate actions based on that.
Sure. So one question before we get into some quickfire predictions. You're obviously spent a significant period of your career, well, not necessarily obviously to everybody, but you did in Japan, working with bureaucracies and private businesses. What's something that a process, an idea, a practice that could be simply adopted or relatively easily? Some things are obviously highly cultural dependent, but there's got to be some things there you go, gosh, if we just copied what they're doing there, copied and pasted, that would be a significant benefit to our public.
I'll make an obligatory disclaimer here, which is I am an individual that has an immigration status in the nation of Japan, to which I intend to return in the future, and I'm somewhat therefore careful about what I say with regards to the operation of the Japanese government. That out of the way, one thing that is very different in Japan versus the United States, which is the country whose polity I'm most informed about that isn't Japan, is that if you go to City Hall with a question on anything that is within the sphere of operation of the government, and you have no idea as a citizen who might not have a lawyer or a competent regulatory expediter at your beck and call, I have no idea who I talk to about this. You just go to the reception desk and ask, I want to open a restaurant. Who are the open the restaurant people? The reception desk will always know who to point you to. And so like simply caring a lot about what the retail experience of government is and what is the equivalent of the reception desk and how do we say like, you know, descriptively, Japan puts some of the best people in the Japanese government at the reception desk and not at the senior levels of policy. That's a choice, and there's pluses and minuses to that choice. But could we care an acute amount about what someone's first experience is with the government when they want to open a restaurant? Can we make sure that the reception desk or the website knows you want to open a restaurant? Here's the first place you talk to. Can we make sure when they get to that place that opening a restaurant is not the highest frequency thing that happens in, say, the city of San Francisco, but it's also not a rare case for the city of San Francisco. And it's not an unknowable case for the city of San Francisco. Obviously, people will attempt to open restaurants next year. Obviously, there is some amount of procedures that they will go to, and we can know those procedures in advance. Let's write down a list of all of them and give people the "so you want to open a restaurant" document when they attempt to engage us about opening those restaurants. And then let's go over, what are the things that are extremely high salience, that are high volume? Like, should we make a checklist that is interactable? Should we expedite this with software? Should we, make people available to walk you through questions about this, et cetera, et cetera? These things round to free, and obviously costs money to put someone out there, but there is no great intellectual content in just saying, if you walk into the city hall in Chicago and ask, who generally should I speak to about taxation issues, making sure they have an answer for that, rounds to free relative to the, multi-billion-dollar budget of the city of Chicago. Let's make that happen versus saying there is no reception desk anymore.
One of the things that I learned when I was in Taiwan researching their public sector was that they had a very long-running program, doing ease of doing business program, where they've just quantified various friction points throughout the system of, interconnecting new, wastewater and blah, 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 all these, taxation issues, permitting, so on, and have just been steadily working their way through the list to make it easier and easier for, and this is particularly targeted at small commercial businesses that, I've written about some of the difficulties they have with permitting, and particularly for large industrial, even TSMC, which has a direct line to the president, has difficulty building new fabs. But leaving that aside, I think this sort of general process of just accounting for all of the different things that happen, like you say, the commercial businesses, and then just sequentially working through them, could be very easily broadly adopted.
Yeah. If I can make a related comment to expand on that, as someone who employed people in a variety of U.S. states for Vaccinate CA, it was maddening to me as a small entrepreneur who had a lot of things on my mind, how difficult it was to simply get spun up with our first employee compliantly in a particular U.S. state, because I had to correlate between here's what the Department of Labor wants, here's what the Taxation Department wants, and here's what a third department wants from me. And there was no single document that listed all of those, they each have a different identification number that you have to apply for, et cetera, et cetera. It seems very clear to me, particularly in an environment where we're doing, nationwide employment via the magic of remote hiring, that there should be a state employee whose job it is to say, you want to hire the citizens of this state? We want to help. What do you need to make that as easy as possible? And how can we decrease the total amount of entrepreneurial effort available to get set up to hire your first employee and start paying us taxes and, payroll, unemployment insurance, et cetera, like, how can we reduce that from a 2-day process to 30 minutes and make it much more deterministic for, it shouldn't require a PhD in HR to successfully employ someone in a state. And hopefully with the remote hiring boom, there's something of a, an internal market where the states that are better at doing that see the benefits of it and other states are rushed to copy. A thing that my once hometown of Ogaki in Japan started to do, which I thought was both beautiful and something that many cities across the world should do, is if you're considering moving to Ogaki, which they would like to encourage because there's been outflow from the Japanese regions to Tokyo over the last many years, they will happily have a city employee get on a Zoom call with you for 60 minutes and hear a little bit about your situation. What's relevant to your interests? You have school-aged children? Let me tell you a little bit about the schools in Ogaki, and then I will read some PR the town has written and tell you about my own experience, and then we go on, our happy days together. And given that if you professional moves to a city, the tax base of that city increases, it seems very obvious to me that almost any town in the Western world should be able to math out, yes, it definitely makes sense for us to have a bespoke conversation with any person who wants to move into this town. Let's make that easy. And again, not rocket science. You have a compassionate individual be willing to talk for a few minutes about your challenges and then read a script and perhaps do a few Google searches on your behalf. Like, perhaps you have a question about, my son has a learning disability. I don't know what Ogaki does about learning disabilities, and I don't know how to look for that because I'm a civilian. Well, you, as someone who works for the city government, is capable of using Google and capable of Googling the obvious things and saying, okay, unsurprisingly, this city has programs with regards to individuals with learning disabilities. And if you and your son were to live here in Ogaki, we would be happy to help you with that. And one place that you could, have as an entry point there is your school. Another place is the following office. I can read you their phone number right now if you want, and you can have a call with a responsible individual. Just be willing to be out there on behalf of citizens and residents.
There's a lot of tacit knowledge as well that can just come through passively about how different things, places are organized geographically or what pinch points might be that... Just it makes it a lot easier for people to move and make that jump.
And I think even if people, organizations did this for a week or two and then asked the people who were doing the calls, what do we hear a lot on those calls? You would get immediate information that you can impact back into the policy arena on, okay, what isn't clear on our website right now? What are, emerging sentiment of people that are considering this town strongly. They are quite concerned about civic beautification, whereas maybe our town has been institutionally concerned with infrastructure development. Maybe we should rationalize those priorities, et cetera, et cetera. Or maybe do a better job of communicating around the things that people mention are priorities where, well, we think we're very good at that, but apparently people still worry about it, so there's a communications gap. Let's rationalize our communication strategy around it. And this is, tech industry would say, if you're a project manager or engineer and aren't routinely getting on the phone or Skype or similar with your users, you're doing it wrong. There's so much low-hanging fruit there, so we should grab it.
Right. Okay, so just to close us out, some quick-fire predictions. You can feel free to either... answer just in the affirmative, negative, or do the super forecaster thing and give a percentage if you want.
So, I'll try to give percentages, but I'm often less numerically inclined than previously on the math team and have an engineering degree would predict. But okay,
fair enough.
Ready for it.
Okay, so firstly, following on from one of the discussion we had about procurement and state capacity, the Californian High-Speed Rail Authority aims to connect Gilroy, which is roughly a 40-minute drive south of San Jose, to Palmdale, which is an hour north of L.A., by 2045. Do you think that this will be complete by 2050?
5%.
Okay. Do you think that San Jose and Hollywood, let's say, so this is in the very south of the Bay Area, not up in San Francisco, but down in the south of the Bay Area, and Hollywood, let's say northern Los Angeles, do you think those two locations will be connected by rail this century?
This century? Okay, this century is a longer time. 60 and increasing, I'll say, weekly health.
Okay. So an AI question. Do you expect the number of public servants to increase or decrease as a percentage of the population as a result of AI adoption over the next decade? So if we did some regression about like the degree of AI adoption within an organization, do you think you would see an increase or decrease in the number of public servants as a result of that?
I do not think that will causationally cause an increase or decrease.
Just unchanged.
Unchanged.
Regarding centralization, 10 years from now, will public systems and jurisdictions be more or less centralized than today? So thinking about, for example, the United States, if you had commentary around, let's say, Japan or other places you're familiar with, that'd be interesting too. Do you think they're going to be... power will be more concentrated in the central state or more devolved to, let's say, local governments and other jurisdictions?
It's complicated, the policy environment being complicated. I will say in the spirit intended, there will be more power in the central government rather than less.
And what would be, do you think, the main driver behind that?
The scale advantages of the internet as a technology, the ability of small numbers of individuals to work their will upon the world by understanding the points of leverage within the system, and also scale advantages to IT generally and to AI specifically will cause like much of the devolution of power to local governments has always been about the subsidiarity argument that you can only understand things when you're in close physical proximity to the problem. If there is a surfeit of understanding in the world that can be solved by having arbitrarily large amounts of cognition to throw at it, and we will soon have arbitrarily amounts of cognition at, well, we status quo as of October 25, have arbitrary amounts of cognition at various levels to throw out problems. And as that gets metabolized by government, a lot of things that were previously only possible if you had 30,000 people across the United States doing them will be possible by a small team of people in Washington. And I think it will be incentive compatible for some of those small teams to actually grab that power that is available.
Right. No, that makes perfect sense. The landscape becoming more and more legible over time, and our ability to influence it only becoming more so. So we're sort of beginning and ending this podcast with discussion of seeing like a state. Look, Patrick, thanks so much for chatting with me.
Thanks very much for your time and attention. And if I can ever help folks out in any capacity, whether you are a central bank or just somebody else on the internet like me, drop me an email.
Wonderful.